This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
After the 66 tour and the motorcycle accident, we all know Dylan went to Woodstock and things changed. Blonde on Blonde came out in mid-1966, and John Wesley Harding came out at the very end of 1967. But there is a world of distance between them. I made the mistake in the conversation you're about to hear in calling it 3 years, but in atmospheric and artistic terms, it seems like even more. It's useful to stop and think about the time frames, changes, and the progression, because we live in a world of retro Bob, where, as Michael Gray says in today's discussion, every quirky album is just another in an ongoing series of quirky Bob Dylan albums. But we miss a lot in the jumble. And in Chapter 5 of Song and Dance Man, Volume 1, Michael Gray tells us, in text largely written in the very early 70s when this all was fresh, how the language Dylan was using in his songwriting was changing, album by album, leaving behind the complexity we heard on the previous couple of issues for a series of new approaches. John Wesley Harding, Nashville Skyline, Self-Portrait, New Morning, Planet Waves, Blood on the Tracks. In today's talk, we take that ride, and we learn about and rethink how Dylan left the masterpiece of Blonde on Blonde totally behind, and for many reasons took a new path that was fruitful along the way, but also seemed to lead to the next masterpiece. Our guest reader this episode is none other than the freewheeling Rob Kelly, host of Pod Dylan. For about 5 years, Rob has been delivering great conversations about Bob Dylan one song at a time. He's still doing it, but now with extended and bonus episodes every month. And yet he still had time to read for us. Thanks, Rob. Now, here's our conversation with Michael Gray. Hi, Michael. Hello again.
Hi.
So the space between 65 and 67 was long and momentous for Dylan in many ways. And when we start getting albums again, everyone can hear that things have changed. This chapter is called Towards a New Simplicity. And it begins talking about what we hear on these first two albums. So we'll start with an excerpt.
In contrast to Blonde on Blonde, Dylan's surrealism is stripped down to its minimum on John Wesley Harding, the most dramatic example being in that central song, All Along the Watchtower. If Desolation Row can be seen as a circular song with its parade going on forever, so too can All Along the Watchtower, which is, among other things, a more economical and far more chilling restatement of the same theme. But how does it end, this song? There are two alternatives. Either it gets an added element of menace from the very endlessness of the nightmare vision offered as the song goes round and round, so that the helpless cry, "There must be some way out of here," recurs after the wind began to howl. Or else, if it is not circular in that way, then it ends, as Richard Goldstein argued in a Village Voice review, on an emphatic full stop. Indeed, a terrifying full stop. Just three clean, razor-sharp verses with an N that signifies the end of everything. Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching. The wind began to howl.
And I don't find it easy to come down on one side or the other on that which way does it end question. I mean, on the one hand, it's not a dot, dot, dot at the end, is it? Even though the wind began to howl. In other words, that maybe the wind then continues to howl. And therefore, how can we be saying, like Richard Goldstein, that it ends with a full stop? Surely that's more like ending with a dot, dot, dot. It implies wind howling on and on. But I'm quite drawn to the other interpretation, which I, as far as I can remember, is mine, which is that that after the wind begins to howl and these people have seen these two riders approaching, they turn back to each other and say, there must be some way out of here. Yeah, I mean, I like that. I have no idea, of course, what Dylan intended. That's not my job.
I wonder if the archives, if there's versions or verses that give any clue to this.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I haven't spent enough time looking at those notebooks. I wish I had. A lot of people have, and Margaret Daniel certainly has.
In the circular nature, are you referring to the theory that, I know Paul Williams wrote about it, I don't know if he started it, that the verses are actually reversed, that the order of the song is third, second, first, but he sings it another way?
I'm not familiar with that. I'd like to think about that. What is the second verse then?
If you go backwards, uh-huh. All along the watchtower, the princes kept the view. Women came and went, barefoot servants too. The wind ending with the wind begins to howl. Verse 2 remains, no reason to get excited. The thief he kindly spoke. Men are here among us who feel life is but a joke. Ends with the hour getting late. And the new last verse says, there must be some way out of here. So the joke to the thief, too much confusion. Businessmen drink my wine. None of them know what any of it is worth. That's the backwards, play it backwards version of All Along the Watchtower.
Okay, well, I guess it's the kind of song where that would work, because it's not as if it's a very crystal clear literal meaning that we have here. I mean, this is a song of mystery. And you could shuffle the verses around. I wasn't actually familiar with Paul Williams's thoughts on that. He was not my favorite Dylan writer. A lot of people think he's fabulous, but I'm afraid I'm not one of them.
Well, let's talk about the more general, though, because this is, right, so we've jumped from Blonde on Blonde to John Wesley Harding. and overall, we've made this change. You happen to call out All Along the Watchtower to begin the chapter, but talk a little bit more about that, the change and the feeling of the change overall of those 3 years.
The first thing is that I'd like to say that John Wesley Harding is really quite separate from what comes after it. I mean, I know John Wesley Harding ends with two sort of country songs, Down Along the Cove and I'll Be Your Baby Tonight. And when I first wrote about them, I sort of assumed that they were kind of parodies of country songs, because it was so unlike Bob Dylan to be singing that kind of stuff. But then when Nashville Skyline came out, of course, there we were. It was all there. But the rest of John Wesley Harding is different, isn't it? I mean, it's much more spare. I mean, it's very different from Blonde on Blonde in having lost the surrealism. But it certainly hasn't offered the kind of country music simplicity that we get on the albums that follow it. It's all very severe, isn't it? I mean, and one of the ways in which it stands out is as a rebuke to what else was going on in rock music when it came out at the very, very beginning of 1968, you know. Everyone's albums were becoming double albums. People were starting to be snobbish about releasing singles. Many acts just didn't. I mean, Blonde on Blonde, of course, had been a double album, and I'm very pleased that it was, because I wouldn't want any of it cut out or squashed up. But you know, then we get Sergeant Pepper, and that is such a lavish sort of packaging of stuff. And you know, the tracks are miraculously recorded on a four-track machine, but it sounds as if it's got lavish orchestras and everyone in the world playing on it. And you know, the Rolling Stones did Satanic Majesty's Requests, and Jefferson Airplane did After Bathing at Baxter's. We were getting into a very self-indulgent, solemn, excessive kind of rock. And Bob Dylan comes along with an album that could hardly be more spare and severe. It just couldn't be, you know. And it's so infested with biblical language. And this, of course, is something that he has always done and always does, even Blowing in the Wind quotes from biblical text, everything he does. I mean, he has been inward with the Bible forever, but he's never made a more outwardly biblical album than John Wesley Harding, aside from the rather different Born Again album. And then, you know, when we come on to Nashville Skyline, well, that's a whole different kind of contrast to the mid-60s work. He's really simplifying the language he uses. I remember the very first time I listened to that album, I was living in an apartment in York, Old York, not New York, and I got this album, the vinyl, and put it on the turntable downstairs where my friend Paul lived. And we listened to this album. We were laughing our heads off because he was so sly about the way that he brought in all this language from Nashville. It was such a clever album. It took a while before feeling that that he was only actually able to do that because he was being very respectful of the songwriting traditions that he was drawing upon. I mean, it is quite close to parody if all you think Bob Dylan normally does is Highway 61 Revisited. All this, you know, My Love, My Baby, you know, it's extremely pop music lyric content, country pop. But obviously it's very warm and he's very fond of it. And who couldn't be? I don't know anyone who doesn't like Nashville Skyline, if they ever like Bob at all. Self-Portrait is different, of course, as we know from what Greil Marcus had to say when he first wrote about it in Rolling Stone.
Let's listen to an excerpt on Nashville Skyline before we get too far ahead.
Okay.
By the time of the Nashville Skyline album, we find, not unexpectedly in the view of its terrain, no trace of surrealistic imagery at all. The images on this album rest as firmly in logic and plain speaking as would be consistent with imaginative expression. They are founded in the logic of traditional rural life, dependent on that life's unvarying rhythms and verities, seasons, the processes of agriculture, growth, replenishment, and death. Turn my skies from blue to gray. Tonight no light will shine on me. Once I had mountains in the palm of my hand and rivers that ran through every day.
It is interesting, the observation you made a second ago. John Wesley Harding is such a downshift, or such a shift from Blonde on Blonde. It does get lumped with really the next three albums, but because of the religious allegory or the storytelling in there, there's a lot of songs in there that many people would say they don't know what the hell he's talking about. As opposed to when you get to Nashville Skyline, as you say, these are very accessible, probably leading to the comfort most people feel with that album that you just mentioned. It's not a challenging album, whereas John Wesley Harding really is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, John Wesley Harding is really quite chilly. It's very severe. And Nashville Skyline is the opposite. I like the observation about it being grounded in, rural life. So you don't necessarily have electric light, for example. So tonight, no light will shine on me. I mean, in a way, you know, obviously all these lines can be taken on two levels, like once I had mountains in the palm of my hand and rivers that ran through every day, you know. This is on one level, obviously talking about a woman's body. On the other hand, it also works on that literal level, He is in the countryside here, and in the countryside, there isn't necessarily electricity. I mean, this is why, all those pre-war blues singers played an acoustic guitar. There was nothing to plug into. There really wasn't. I mean, Blind Willie McTell, I think in at least one of the towns that he lived in, not villages, towns, they didn't get mains electricity till 1938. You know, they were playing acoustic, not out of choice like Bob, but because there was no choice. And Dylan's very attuned to this rural life. I mean, he's always loved it in a way. He likes coming from Minnesota. I mean, it's a long way from Nashville, but nevertheless, you know, it's not Chicago.
It is interesting. There's this grand theory a lot of people have about the last song on Bob's albums, you know, pointing to the next. And this, the fact that John Wesley Harding ends with "I'll Be Your Baby Tonight," which not only is that kind of song, but has the word baby in it. And if you look at it and look up the set list there to, you know, Drifter's Escape and Frankie Lee and Pity the Poor Immigrant, it could, "I'll Be Your Baby Tonight" could easily be from another album. It really does bridge forward beautifully.
Yeah.
We have another quote from of you talking about Nashville skyline in similar vein.
It was, after all, quite a shock on a first play of Nashville skyline back in 1969 to hear Dylan singing lines like "For Your Love Comes On So Strong." And when we come to the middle section of the same song, "Tonight I'll Be Staying Here With You," we find Dylan coming on even stronger with this new language. Is it really any wonder? The love that a stranger might receive? You cast your spell and I went under. I find it so difficult to leave. This compares closely with the middle section of the later song "Hazel" from Planet Waves. "Oh no, I don't need any reminder to show how much I really care, but it's just making me blinder and blinder." The joke rhyming of wonder and under, and even more so of reminder and blinder, combined with the playful vacuousness of the melodies of both these sections, suggests the milieu of Hollywood musical more than anything. They'd go comfortably inside "On the Street Where You Live" from My Fair Lady, not exactly Dylan terrain.
There's a big section of this chapter, or several pages in this chapter, where you talk about the real-time reaction and people not knowing what to think, and it's very easy to understand, right? Coming out of Blonde on Blonde, and a few years, and that time, you know, for people was a long time, but all of a sudden this guy's again doing something you would not expect at all in a society that's used to more of the same.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I was talking about all those sort of self-indulgent progressive rock developments, but it would be misleading to suggest by that I felt totally out of tune with that and recognizing that what we needed was country simplicity. I mean, I didn't feel that at all, you know. This was the exciting 1960s and they were still exploding. And who wanted to go to country music? I mean, it was at the time the most reactionary kind of music that you know, anyone outside of, I don't know, outside of musicals, you couldn't find any more right-wing a genre than country music. And, you know, you just had to look at any country music TV show or television clip. I mean, the clothes these people wore, you know, the Loretta Lynns. And I mean, you know, they were living on a completely other planet from the people who went to Woodstock. The Gulf was massive. And so, yeah, in real time, it was absolutely flabbergasting that Bob Dylan gave us Nashville Skyline. But you know, he didn't go to Woodstock either.
Yeah, and there's, you know, you take this album and certain songs from all these albums to task, you know, in the book. I have a few little quotations here, meaning just phrases. Apparently second-rate collection. Somewhere you say the blandness of defeat.
It's clear to me that a phrase like the blandness of defeat as a way of condemning a, his country music or his simplistic, more simplistic music. I mean, that is straight from when there still seemed to be battle lines. Now we just live in a kind of consumerist society where you just, you know, go to Spotify or whatever and listen to what you like. But back then, things were changing, and were they going to carry on changing in the liberating way that seemed to be happening late in the 1960s? You know, that was the time when young Americans were at their most radical. You know, and the civil rights movement had obviously made a great deal of progress, and there was a lot of white radical activity as well as Black Panther activity. You were either on the side of the Woodstock people or you were on the side of people who walked around looking like Loretta Lynn.
Yeah, and in that first case, to have Lay Lady Lay, One More Night, and Country Pie as what your I want to say leader, but the unwilling leader is putting out, it has to be quite shocking.
But at the same time, you know, it was immediately apparent. I mean, as I say, from my first listen, that it was extremely skillful, and that really he was on top of his material. He knew exactly what he was doing, which hasn't always been the case down the many decades of his work, but back then it seemed to be. Whereas I think I get criticized for calling Self-Portrait a mistake in a review that we've just had, or volume one, in fact, yeah, by someone I've never heard of, but thanks for the review.
Billy Mills, yeah. Well, let's talk about Self-Portrait, because the other interesting thing, we talked last time a lot about time and the way Bob stretches it or compresses it. And, you know, we have John Wesley Harding in 67, National Skyline in 69. And as you pointed out, John Wesley Harding is effectively 1968, meaning it was the very end of the year. So we have 68, 69, and 70 for these three albums, which, and then, you know, New Morning comes, and that's not too far away, but these three albums.
I mean, that's two albums in 1970.
Right, right. I've made this observation in other places. I think it's valuable to look at Dylan. If there was an artist who just had those four albums and didn't have the 60s thing behind him, as you say, they're skillful. They're an evolution of their own. They're full of wonderful songs, but not something you may associate with Bob Dylan if you knew the 10 years before. Yeah. And by the time you get to Self-Portrait, you've got a lot of covers, and we all know the story of that album now that we didn't know then, at least in terms of the production and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it seems to me that you can always take out a particular album of Bob's and say, if this was the only thing he'd ever done, he'd still be great. Well, it's actually impossible to say that, because if he hadn't done the other stuff, he wouldn't have trained us in how to appreciate him the same way. You know, he spent a lot of time training people, especially through the 1960s and 70s, in how to appreciate him and not rush to judgment and not expect him to be like other people and not expect him to do the same thing over and over again. And he did that in terms of his live performances and his recordings and the material that he wrote. But, you know, the key fact remains that the mid-60s work changed all of us, because it knocked down the walls of song, as I've said before, and everything was possible in song after that for everyone. But to go back to the point about, if you just took this little cluster of albums, how would they be? Well, I don't know. I think Self-Portrait is still the weak member of that cluster. And that's not because of the covers, because You know, he can do covers beautifully. But there's just something slightly kind of lackluster about the way that he performs the songs that are most like his kind of folky stuff.
Did the revised edition and all the wonder of that bootleg series change your thinking on that?
It didn't change how I think the original album is. And in many ways, I prefer the original album to the reissue version, because it makes no sense to me at all to take layers of recording away from Copper Kettle, and certainly makes no sense to take them away from Wigwam. These are much better on the first version. Copper Kettle is the most immaculate track. It's just marvelous. It's absolutely perfect. And his voice is so sensitive to every possible way of hearing that song. You know, people have done that song drearily forever. And he comes along and does it in this very sort of, in quotes, inauthentic way. And he liberates the song and makes it live for you. And Wigwam, you know, I love Wigwam with all the trumpets and stuff on. Why would you want to lose any of that? No, the ones that I think are lackluster on the original album are tracks like Alberta and Alberta Number 2 and Days of 49 and Little Sadie. And It Hurts Me Too. It Hurts Me Too. You know, he could have done that far better. It's a Tampa Red song that he likes. He likes Tampa Red's material. He opens all those 1978 live concerts with Tampa Red songs. He respects them, but he doesn't seem to bother to put much energy into the version he puts on Self-Portrait. And, you know, why Alberta and Alberta Number 2? There's almost no difference between them. There's a difference between Little Sadie and In Search of Little Sadie, but ho-hum.
But take five of those songs that you mentioned and then replace them with Annie's Gonna Sing Her Song, These Hands, This Evening So Soon. I think the reason a lot of people felt like the bootleg series volume 10 changed their evaluation of Self-Portrait was that as often, if you picked different takes or different songs, you could have made an album that would have had a far different reaction than Self-Portrait did at the time. And
I'm not sure it would have done in 1970. I think it would have been beset with exactly the same problems of how people could respond to it.
Interesting. Before we continue, I want to mention something obvious. This entire chat is an extension of the amazing Song and Dance Man, The Art of Bob Dylan, the book Michael Gray wrote, and specifically Volume 1 of the 50th Anniversary Edition, which you can purchase at Amazon in paperback or on Kindle. The book was revised twice, so while it was originally written in the early 70s and covers the 60s and 70s in a deep contemporary fashion as we're discussing today, it was updated twice with extensive footnotes, additions, and even Michael arguing with his earlier self. This is the sixth episode of our podcast discussion stemming from the content of the book. And if you've been enjoying them, you owe it to yourself, and perhaps to Michael Gray, to grab a copy of the full book. Trust me, the great excerpts and info you're hearing here is just a fraction of what you'll discover and enjoy in the full book. I've read it before, but rereading and preparing for these talks, it's nearly impossible because nearly every paragraph has something that I want to discuss with Michael. Just search Michael Gray at Amazon, or there are links in the show notes. Well, let's move on to a passage from the book where you talk about New Morning, which obviously arrives next, and as you say, very quickly.
New Morning arrived just a few months after Self-Portrait, and while in singing style and timbre, it shows something like a return toward blonde-on-blonde modes of expression, It signaled just the same that the new simplicity of language was not to be abandoned. Creatively, perhaps, beyond this chiseling of language, New Morning confirmed that, as he entered the 1970s, the rock poet genius of the 1960s was resting. On it, Dylan has lost that amazing urgency of communication, that arresting quality, that abrasive presence, and has nothing much to say. Obviously, the two things are connected, although one is a matter of delivery, of performance, while the other is a matter of vision. But the lack of one always betrays, in Dylan's art, the lack of the other.
It's certainly the case that he doesn't go back to the kind of language of Blonde on Blonde. And of course, it was understandable that he would extraordinarily strongly resent the response to that album in Rolling Stones. But the headline was, "We've got Dylan back," when that album was reviewed. Well, you know, he wasn't the same Dylan. New Morning is an album that still seems to me to get better and better as the years go by. I think we were too close to it in 1970. It was still an embattled America. It's an extraordinary period in American history, and an extraordinary period of young radicalism. And 1970, you know, this is George Jackson time as well as New Morning. And yet, for me, it's different now, you know. I think that in the first version of this book, I actually criticized New Morning for being overproduced. And later, I think, again, in the book, I backtrack from that and say, you know, in more recent decades, it sounded as if it was more or less home recorded around the campfire. But certainly the country persona of Bob is still there, despite his kind of gospel piano playing and all these ingredients that are from different kinds of American popular music. But certainly, you know, the standout track for me, at least, is always going to be Sign on the Window. And Sign on the Window is, you know, Country Bob again, isn't it? Build me a cabin in Utah. Have a bunch of kids who call me Pa. But that is a wonderful recording. And the only thing that's not wonderful is when Al Kooper starts messing about with putting extra instruments on it on one of the outtakes, which is horrible.
Yeah, like Nashville Skyline, New Morning is pleasant and accessible and kind of easy to listen to and nice. But let's talk a little bit about, since it came up this week with the reissue, The Man in Me. Because I've always, you know, it seems like a slightly standout track in the writing and the delivery, and it's picked up this currency over time that you wouldn't think a song like that would. I mean, obviously because of some covers and other things, but Bob has also,
yeah,
you know, kept with it. You talk about the writing and some of the lines in the in the book in talking about that, but
I think it's quite a good song. I think in a way it's a sort of, it's a bit sort of legend building, or it seemed to be at the time, you know. The man in me will hide sometimes to keep from being seen, but that's because he doesn't want to turn into some machine. I mean, that's more or less, you know, that's like a sort of press release from Bob Dylan about why he's an awkward performer and why he's not cooperative with the press and so on, isn't it? It's more like a sort of press release than a verse of genuine feeling, it seems to me. But on the other hand, I love the stuff about storm clouds are raging all around my door. I think to myself, I might not take it anymore. I mean, I can't really justify why that's so much better, but it really is. And when he uses the word wintry in Every Grain of Sand, echoing William Blake, the wolf at the wintry door, you know, there's quite a lot of this I'm okay in my cabin stuff. It's there in On a Night Like This as well. That sort of sense that you're in somewhere cozy, and the world might be howling outside. So that's a part of the man in me that I like. It's nicely vague, the actual phrase, the man in me. I mean, it's not too grossly male, is it? But to takes a woman like you to find the man in me, well, I don't know. It's not my favorite song on New Morning. And the version that we're just going to get from the Complete Budokan, where, you know, when he was doing those songs, he was rewriting them on the spot, as it were, in some of those early performances, going, gone. I mean, to some extent, it's prepared, it's thought out. It's no coincidence that the 1978 live going, gone has a lot of Robert Johnson lines in it. You know, he's sewn them in there. He's put them in there. And so I dare say he's thought about this, the lyric that he uses on this just about to be released, The Man in Me, live from 78 from Budokan. The verse that seems to me to be sharp is the one about, I don't want it to be true, but I'm lying next to her and I'm thinking of you. That's pretty strong writing, really. Whereas the one that comes after that just seems to me to be, rather sloppily put together lines. It seems to me a bit flaccid, and flaccid is not what you want to seem when you're claiming to have the hots for someone.
One of the things about this period is it reflects the geography, in that, right, these are the Woodstock albums as opposed to the New York albums that we got in the 60s. And yes, one of the reasons they're the Woodstock albums is Dylan's family life and his personal life, as it were, and how we're hearing about it on these albums.
Yes.
Here's an excerpt about that from this chapter.
Dylan's happy family man role, irrespective of how it applied at the time to his private life, is unconvincing in his art. You don't render a vision of happiness by insisting that you're happy, or simply by using a bland voice. This is what Dylan attempts, wrongly, on Nashville Skyline and Self-Portrait, and he does so again on New Morning, yet with a significant difference on how it comes out. Self-awareness of this fault shows through on tracks like If Not For You. The accompanying self-effacement, sometimes self-apology, makes for an odd contradictoriness not found in Dylan's other work.
There's quite a bit of a push you make on these albums, on these grounds, in the text here surrounding this. There's a quote of the falsification of rural ideas as idealized rather than real, which is really interesting because so many other places, what you point out is where Dylan manages to get real into lyrics and into song in a way that other people don't.
Of course, in a way that's true, but all country music idealizes the country. What else is it going to do? I mean, I think I was very severe on that aspect of Bob's life, or work rather, not his life, his work. I think that
this is early 70s writing, I assume.
Yeah, this is early 70s writing. I mean, this is still wanting things to change in a way that they haven't. I mean, in Britain, we thought we were abolishing people like Margaret Thatcher, and then she comes along and wipes the floor with us all. And same with Reagan in the States. All that radicalism just disappears in a puff of smoke. But at the time, it just seemed, I do think I'm right in saying that you cannot creatively render a mood of happiness simply by claiming that you're happy. And it may be that it's a very, very, very difficult thing to create authentically, because I think very little art tries to do that. You know, mostly art tries to disturb rather than express happiness. It challenges rather than soothes. And in Dylan's case, of course, what was challenging about these albums was their soothingness, if you like, the fact that they weren't being radical as he had been.
And the further challenge is so many people have badly tried to prove they're happy by saying they're happy, that it's a cliche and you expect it to fail because you've seen it fail so many times.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we have that interesting, 4-year period, if we will, with four albums. Then we get a little bit of a break. I mean, at least from releases, and then the next 1-2 punch is Planet Waves and Blood on the Tracks. So let's first hear a passage about that transition, that next transition.
With Planet Waves, without a doubt, Dylan has come a lot closer than he had on New Morning to forging his own new resources of language. With Blood on the Tracks, his progress suddenly shows through in a tremendous, unexpected leap forwards and upwards. This album is almost certainly his best and puts the constant struggle between Blonde on Blonde or Highway 61 and Nashville Skyline, the struggle enacted in New Morning and Planet Waves, dramatically behind him. There is no longer an ebb and flow between these two extreme modes of expression. There is, on a whole new plateau, as it were, a successfully attained fresh language that is the new simplicity, and in which, as ever in the best of Dylan's work, simplicity is deceptive, communicating more by being able confidently to say less.
Well, I can't better that as a description of what goes on there in that shift from New Morning through to Blood on the Tracks. No, I can't better that. I think, you know, I wanted to say about the earlier work we've been discussing, that it comes back to time in the way that we've talked about before. At the time, hearing these things one by one as they came out and were new was a very different experience from flopping around in Bob's catalogue afterwards. I mean, of course, you know, nobody in the 1990s is surely going to be indignant at the countrification of Bob in Nashville Skyline. You know, I mean, it's just a quirky album in his long catalogue of quirkiness. So it's very different. Living through it live by live, album by album, certainly I completely still agree that we see this shift, these struggles out of Nashville with New Morning, and he's still working the same push-pull conflicts and explorations of how to write songs that are not clever or radical, but are nevertheless purposive and real. And we have that in New Morning, and we have it in Planet Waves. And then, pow, it all comes clean with Blood on the Tracks. Yeah.
One of the great things about this book and about really any attempt or any effort to look at the albums in the way that you did is that for those of us, and that at this point is the vast majority of people, who came to Bob in some strange direction, not linear, is that there is the presentation of the albums kind of on their own, a little bit where they stood in the timeline. But more importantly, it's just a focused view of the album pushing the other things aside. It does provide a sense of focus that most of us have never had on something about the time, something about that collection of songs, the way the album related to the other ones that we get to take with us. So the next time, you know, I hear these things. I didn't have the period when it came out, but I at least had this period when at least I was focused on it and being guided through it and put into that context a little bit.
Anyway. I'm pleased that, you know, that this works in terms of people coming to the book and dealing with Bob's albums or understanding that they could have been processed in that way. Yeah. Sure.
I mean, to some degree, it's useful, obviously, for many reasons. But in this context, that at the time you wrote these things down because you couldn't get back there in your head to when it was new now either. Oh, I didn't want to rush past Planet Waves because the book is very complimentary and positive about the Planet Waves songs and the work on Planet Waves. In the new Mixing Up the Medicine, one of the little details, there's a story and I'm sure some artifact in there about that when the 74 tour was about to launch, or they'd committed to it, Geffen and Arista, where he was temporarily, asked him for an album. And he happened to have just bought a house in LA and from an artist, and the artist had a studio. And he went in and kind of banged out these dozen songs. And it was almost, I don't know, they don't make it particularly clear if it was kind of on request. Hey, Bob, go in the room and write us an album. But the query had come and he had spent this time in this. It was kind of an origin story of that album that I hadn't heard before and didn't know anything about and is very interesting. But it is, it is a wonderful album and there's so much really tremendous things on there. And you really give it a lot of time in the book that I think many people love that album. It's hard sitting right next to Blood on the Tracks in the catalog. And it's.
Yeah. I mean, apart from anything else, it's so musically lovely, isn't it? It's just beautiful. And it's so good that there is a studio album with the band playing with him. And like New Morning, it's an album that just seems a lot better now than it maybe did at the time. I mean, okay, I was writing complimentary things about it at the time, but actually, when I very first heard it, I didn't feel that way. When it was absolutely new, it was another kind of a betrayal of the radical thrust of where we were all going. You know, when he says in Wedding Song, that it wasn't his job to march in the parade of liberty. I mean, I know that's a quote from Abandoned Love instead, but he does talk in Wedding Song, doesn't he, about it wasn't my job to do this stuff. And at the time, you know, I think a lot of people like me thought, well, yes, it was, Bob. It was your job fighting for radical change in America. You know, you'd written all these great songs about how awful things were and how different they ought to be. So you know, don't tell me you've only ever been interested in cuddling up to somebody and with the fire and putting the coffee grounds on and you know, doodly doodly winterlude. You know, that's not the Bob that we thought we'd signed up for. There was a very brief period when my father died, when I kind of got mixed up between him disappearing on me and Bob disappearing on me, and I wrote a very impassioned long article about this, which I have never published, but which catches me before I came to appreciate the virtues and strengths of Planet Waves.
Talk about the language evolution, though, since that's what we're focusing on. I'm looking at this list of songs from Planet Waves, and you know, many of them do, as things as only Bob stuff can do, feel like they're right there. You can't really imagine Going Gone or Dirge or Hazel would be the three I might pull the most out, you know, anywhere else. Or Wedding Song's another one that they just feel like they're Planet Waves songs. They have a confidence and a, you know, the subject matter is relatively simple relationship, but not the ooh baby kind of words we were maybe getting a little bit earlier.
And also, you know, rather than harking back to Nashville, they hark back to Minnesota, don't they? There's all the stuff about walking the hills of old Duluth and a long forgotten truth and never say goodbye, twilight on the frozen lake, north wind about to break on footsteps in the snow and silence down below. I mean, that is marvelous writing at the beginning of Never Say Goodbye. Just wonderful. But it's very, you know, he mentions Duluth. I mean, there's no arguing with which frozen lakes he's talking about here. He's talking about the state of Minnesota, which has 10,000 of those frozen lakes.
Yeah, you make this point very nicely in the book about Dylan looking back, coming to grips with where he is, with where he's been, with the knowledge and experience that he's able to bring, that about revisiting Minnesota, as you say, as an adult, and marrying the past and present, which is a phrase you use particularly about Wedding Song. But I think that's kind of where this is. It's he's not recuperating from something just happened. He's not trying to figure out where to go next.
Yeah.
He's kind of hit, you know, you use the phrase plateau in a positive way about Blood on the Tracks in a moment, but this is kind of him. He's regathered his wits, and he is where he is. We get a tremendous album, and obviously the band
helps
that the songs are there.
That's a fair summary of what its virtues are and where he seems to be at the time. Yeah.
All right, so let's dive into Blood on the Tracks with an excerpt.
Again, as ever on this unsurpassed album, the simplicity of language represents the opposite of a dullness of emotion. Throughout, from the deft movie script of Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts to the scrupulously checked-in intensity of You If You See Her, Say Hello, a marvelous rewrite of Girl of the North Country, and from the flawless blues of Meet Me in the Morning to the barbed sanity of Buckets of Rain, Blood on the Tracks is the work of an artist who has never been of sharper intelligence nor more genuinely preoccupied with the inner struggles and complexities of human nature. Dylan's sensibility here is 100% intact. He is also an artist who has lost, on Blood on the Tracks, not one iota of his devotion to, nor expertise with, a wide range of American music.
That's good. That's very good stuff. I think it was true, obviously, at the time, at least to me, and it's remained true. It's odd now, looking back, that at the time that people first heard it, they had a lot of qualms about it, you know, from people including John Lennon saying, you know, there's not enough music on it, it's too bare, it's too simple, all that stuff, you know. The reviews were not all five-star rave reviews when it was new. Mine was in Let It Rock magazine. It is interesting in retrospect that it could ever have been not a five-star rave review album. But in fact, it wasn't at the time. It was mixed. Some people liked it a lot straight away. But some people thought, you know, there should be more in it than this, more music. And I don't know. I can't remember now what else the criticism was, but it was a slow burner, perhaps.
I didn't know that. Well, that makes the point another way that we were just making, that, you know, the real-time review, I don't know that it makes it better or worse, but I mean, first of all, these things need to be lived with because No one has the ability to take in everything there instantly. But then the context just changes and probably third, the weight of everyone else's opinion shoves people around, whether they want it or not.
Yeah.
Most people, not you, Michael, but most people.
I mean, one of the things that was clear to me straight away about that album was that he had completely knocked out of the window any idea that people were only any use when they were very young, when they made their early rebellious, different and interesting music, that, and then they were bound to, you know, come down after that and end up being Bing Crosby. And that this album just made it absolutely clear that Bob Dylan was freed from the chains of the 60s by this album, that he was no longer an old 60s guy who was making boring records like Self-Portrait. Here was a mature artist, and quite clearly it was possible, therefore, for even the most extremely distinctive and original artist, someone like Bob Dylan, they could do in their 30s work at least as interesting as anything they'd done in their 20s. And therefore, it threw open the door that made it possible to imagine that that he could carry on making interesting albums for years, if not decades, to come. And this in itself was sort of a new idea at the time, you know, that someone could outlive the decade that they had made so important and been so important in.
Right. And people make a lot of him being the first, you know, 50 or 60 or 80-year-old artist. But for the kind of music he helped create in the 60s, he was the first 35-year-old too.
Yes.
It also seems like for the theme and thesis of these few chapters, right, he's arrived at mastery of language again and communication and art, and yet there's not a whiff of complexity, I don't think, to be found on that album. And we can look at this set we just went through of the Woodstock albums and through the others to say he set on another path and reached the top kind of another mountain.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things here is that that he has mastered less is more. That he has mastered less is more. And that's part of the simplicity here. If you see her say hello, that song, it doesn't say anything complicated, doesn't say anything using complex language, but it's quite clear that that there's a subtext to this song and that he's not saying, don't let her know about me, really, and so on.
Well, it's a wonderful chapter, and it ends that, to some degree, this sequence of the book. I mean, we had the two episodes we just did on complexity and then now simplicity. Michael, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.